Always Record Episode 124 with Wally Sherrill.
Got me the strangest woman. Believe me, this chick's no cinch. But I really get her going when I take out my big 10-inch record of the band that plays the blues. The band that plays the blues. She just loved my big 10-inch record of her favorite blues. Tried to tease her, I gave her a little pinch, but she said, now stop that jiving and get out that big 10-inch record of the band that plays the blues. Well, the band that plays the blues. She just loved my big 10-inch record of her favorite blues. I cover her with kisses when we're in a lover's clinch, and when she gets all excited, she begs for my big 10-inch record of the band that plays the blues. Well, the band that plays the blues. She just loves that big 10-inch record of her favorite blues.
I mean, they lowered the age to 18. You know, you can't go get drunk, but you can go die in the name of freedom.
Debate over this Confederate flag business.
Right.
You know, and it's like, and again, so it's like I totally get it on a symbolic level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, sort of to me, seemingly missing the point of a number of things here. So, just as most basic, so a bunch of people died, the conversation become less about these people who died, you know, and more about somebody else's pet political project.
Totally.
And not to trivialize it, you know, but no. To say essentially that is terrorism, right? If you take a terror, an action of violence and use it for political goals, that's actually the definition of terrorism. So here's a murder spree that people are utilizing for their political agenda. Whether or not I agree with it or disagree with it, my point is simply that it seems like I have mixed feelings about that aspect of it. It's like you're utilizing someone's tragedy for your political ends.
Right.
And then the other sort of the bigger scope of it for me is, for sure, it's a symbol of, you know, the Confederate flag is a symbol of hatred and slavery, but isn't every fucking flag? Like, I look at the American flag and I kind of puke a little in my mouth, like...
Right.
You know...
No, I think it makes... It's an odd irony that there is so much, you know, hoopla over one particular symbol while, like you're saying, while we totally kind of ignore the elephant in the room, that there really isn't a flag that isn't flown, you know, above some state... That doesn't have in its, you know, some dark history, you know, either a little or a lot, but and I
yeah, exactly. You could go around the world or around the country, right? Every flag is probably to a lot of people a symbol of oppression,
right.
Or and to some people a symbol of freedom. You know, to some
right.
They're like, yay, I love this country or this. You know, this government gave me free healthcare. I love it. So someone
right.
else is like, this government made me buy healthcare. I hate it. You know, it's like, how do you want to read into those symbols?
Right. Well, it's interesting, too, because I think for the, you know, it was an interesting convergence. The shooting became a gun issue and a race issue, and which really increased the complexity of the issue. And so instead, to your point, you know, the media and the public really shifted the focus of the argument to something that could be reduced down to, are you for it or against it, which is, you know, this flag bullshit. And you're right, it is a distraction. And I mean, interestingly enough, you know, at the same time that like the Supreme Court decision today is in many ways merely a symbolic victory, because it's going to only open up a whole nother can of worms in many ways. But at the same time, the fact that the media and the public were able to divert attention to this symbolic argument suddenly makes it very powerful. The symbol was very powerful in that situation.
Right? Absolutely. And it's hard not to get pulled into it. Right. As I'm saying, like, as I said, I wasn't trying to trivialize it.
No, I understand.
You know, like I said, I'm in one respect it's great news, and in another respect it's like, you know, I guess here's the thing. What I'm trying to do is to appreciate that for a lot of people this is a victory moment, this is something that, you know, a validation, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of, the whole picture is sort of like, who gets to decide what's validated?
Right.
And when they're on your side, it's easy to say, yay, this thing gave, you know, approves of my love life or my wife's, you know, choices. And then when it, you know, it's like, it's almost like giving it that power to decide the thing, even if it's the thing you agree with, there's a sort of sand trap around it. Is okay, I like that this thing says I can do this. This is great.
Right.
But then you've given it that power, now it can say, you know what, I don't think you can do this. And right.
It kind of perpetuates the idea that there's maybe a right or a wrong answer to it, you know?
Yeah.
As if it needed to be even called into question, you know? I think the one thing, and I totally appreciate that, you know, that it's a, you know, that you are aware of like the deeper, or I guess just the more subtle but long-term kind of implications of things like this. And I think that for me, and just looking like back in history, when you look at any type of paradigm shift, whether it's social or technological or spiritual or whatever, there is a very predictable pattern about in terms of like how the public responds. There's always a range of responses that are relatively similar in terms of kind of the different types of ideologies they represent or whatever. But the one thing that I've noticed that where you actually see an impact about those types of paradigm shifts that happen, that is something to, I guess, to get excited about, is all of the people born after that moment in time who are born into a world where they, from their earliest memory, these ideas of how society defines X, Y, and Z, whatever, it's set, it's that way from the moment they, you know, are conscious, basically. And I think that it's like kids, you could even, you know, people make similar arguments like about how kids growing up in the age of the internet who are born into the world of, you know, iPads or whatever are,
sure,
and,
yeah,
and the impact it had, just the impact being born into the world of iPads has on a young generation, right? I think you can apply that lens to so many different things, whether it's technology or, like I said, or politics, et cetera. And so I think if you look at it in more of a long-range sense, because real change really only occurs at a much slower pace than I think anyone of us have, people alive today have the patience for. So today it's like, you know, I think it's a good thing, you know, it's like, sure. Or you could make the same argument about race. Like, okay, you know, the right wing likes to say, there's a common soundbite about like, you know, oh, racism's over, we elected a black person. And it's like, right, clearly right, that electing a black person has not solved racism. And
you could, if anything, it actually brought, I think it brought it really to the surface.
No, it made it rear its ugly fucking head is what it did.
Yeah.
And the same could be said if we elect a woman. Is sexism going to be over? Fuck no. It's going to put it front and center again, you know? But I think that at the same time, that really only applies to the people who are kind of living through it, living through these changes, versus the people who are going to be born into worlds where these changes are already established. Even though they may be unstable, but they're,
you know
what I mean? And so, I mean, I like the idea of people being born into worlds where people, something that doesn't, you know, other than a white male can do things like be a president or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good thing for people to see as they're growing up. Because I think that that's really the only time you're going to get through to people is when they're like three.
I could totally respect that. Like, I think, because, you know, I often think about, like, so, you know, I'm married. I know you are too. You guys don't have kids, right?
No, but I'm about to. My wife's pregnant, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that's actually been completely, like, it totally took over my life for, like, the last 6 weeks or so. But everything's fine, so.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we're really excited.
Is this like new news?
It's relatively new. It's about, yeah, she's due in early January, so we're just ending the first trimester here soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you're lucky you'll have a Capricorn.
Right. I know. It's pretty cool.
I one of the things that I often am admittedly nervous about mm-hmm. is like when I think about bringing children to this world is like they're going to come into a world not knowing a time when there wasn't like an NSA to monitor every fucking thing you do or that you
there
could
you
get
go.
That you could travel without you know
right.
having to strip naked at the airport
totally
you know but. So what I'm saying is your point is
can be flipped.
Really, yeah, exactly.
It really can. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's like, no, I guess you're – so I'm saying I'm seeing the silver lining in your point is that, right, at least, you know, these kids will also be brought up in a world where there are you know, it's not just the negatives that they're going to be brought
right.
into. There's going to be positives and
right.
there will be things. That's cool.
It's true, and I think that it's important – just to your point also in general of like seeing past kind of just the gloss of the mainstream of what kind of the current zeitgeist or whatever, you know, there's a great essay by Steven Pinker about the perception of violence that occurs in the world versus reality. And he has these just two charts of statistics. And one is amount of violence, you know, occurring relatively on the planet, and for like the last century, you know, as far as they, you know, as detailed as they have records for. And then there's a corresponding graph of number of news reports being published or broadcast about violent acts. And it is, you literally superimpose these two graphs, and it's just an X. I mean, it's like actual amount of violence occurring historically is consistently been going down for like 3,000 years. But especially in the last century, reporting of violence occurring in the world has increased by several order of magnitude, you know, every decade. And so
right.
there's this perception issue in that, you know, it's impossible to avoid information about violence happening these days.
And I guess
right,
even right, because like even in the unending wars that we are growing up knowing,
mm-hmm.
they might be on a smaller scale.
Much
than
smaller
say,
scale.
Right, you know, oh, right. okay, we go and we rape and pillage an entire country and, you know, now we just, you know, we kill a few million people and put a McDonald's in them, we're done.
Yeah, pretty much. But even numbers that high are very rare these days, you know. Like, I mean, I don't want to belittle any loss of life at all, but you know, compared to World War II, I mean, Vietnam, obviously there was quite a, you know, was a significant number of deaths compared to the Gulf War and the Iraq War. But even Vietnam compared to Korea, I think, was, like, it's consistently gone down. I should look up the exact statistics, but I don't think it's ever been as bad as World War II.
I haven't looked at the numbers, and I'm really not trying to belittle your point. Is to say, I have to wonder, though, you know, there's the kinder, gentler machine gun hand, as Neil Young would say.
Uh-huh.
In the sense that, like, say, with Iraq, right? Like, after the Gulf War,
mm-hmm.
very few, you know, what was it, 6 days of actual fighting and violence. But the sanctions that we put on, this statistic show 1 million Iraqis died from being denied food, water, and medicine.
I believe that.
Is that violence? You know, to me, that's violence, but it's a sure. bureaucratic... It's a bureaucratic maneuver.
Well, it's violence that occurs at a slower rate.
Exactly.
So, which, you know, suddenly doesn't qualify for statistics. You know,
right.
No, and that's a good point. I mean, that's like I said earlier. Change occurs at a slow rate, and even bad change.
I'm really not trying to be negative. I guess my point is to say, like, these are all interesting. Like, if we're as you said, we can't avoid data.
Right.
So it's trying to figure out, like. As what are we trying to do? We're trying to assess that data and figure
right.
out what do we make of
it. My general point was that there is a tendency, at least, for a kind of sky is falling attitude about about violence in general that occurs. And
for sure.
I don't want to necessarily be an advocate of violence, but I'm also, you know, realistic about human nature, and also encouraged by actual statistics that indicate that there is a constant decline in violence.
Yeah.
Historically, I mean, it's just constant, and hopefully it's going to stay that way, you know, and that's, and my point is I just think that I was just commenting sometimes on, you know, good intentions kind of going a little bit awry when misinformed, and it's not necessarily anyone's fault, considering the fact that we're just like it's unavoidable, this information, you know, about horrible things happening, and that's the news that travels fast, you know. That's the saying, right? If it bleeds, it leads.
Oh, absolutely. And I get, but I guess, and I think we understand each other clearly, so I'm not trying to push the issue, but to say, I guess my point is that there's a it's a question. But let's put it this way. It's a question. Does the decrease in actual violence reflect a decrease in human nature? Reflect a change in human nature in the sense of, like, nowadays we don't have to get on a Viking ship and go, like, ransack a village. Some guy in a desk with a suit and a tie makes a phone call, there's a corporate merger or whatever. Okay, these people are out of jobs. I took their pension. Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, Nestle can buy the water rights for an entire country, and you know, it's a pen and paper transaction. It's the pen is mightier than the sword.
Well,
so like
you said, it's
violence,
a transaction. It's a
The violence is decreased, but does the human nature to is that really reflected in that?
Well, I think that that's...
Have we become a more efficient machine of...
Right. Well, I think that industry is and number crunching and very intelligent people working behind the scenes at all sorts of think tanks and corporations and whatnot have probably determined that, you know, the bottom line will benefit a lot more if you're less aggressive in general.
Yeah.
I mean, to sum it up without going into a long-winded spiel, but I think that, that gets into a whole other territory of I've always just felt you know, the complacence in that you that it seems to be kind of everywhere, it's troubling. It's like there's not a sense I have at least in this country that there's really a very large group of people willing to kind of to really fight for whatever it is that they believe in, you know, and like in the spirit of revolution or whatever. And I feel it's like people a vast majority of people have reached a standard of living that they feel is not worth losing or risking even to kind of, to stand up for what they believe in. And I'm one of them, man. It's terrifying to kind of like, you know, and I've been raised in that system to kind of, you know, fear being out on my ass completely. And so, you know, I get a paycheck and makes me feel like a hypocrite sometimes, but
I mean, you've hit the nail on the head for me, where I've been in my head this whole last week, in the sense of, so there's the this guy in Charleston. I do not sympathize with his, if anything, I find it fascinating that he's in Charleston, where, and I don't think they're behind this or anything, but just the synchronicity of this is where Red Ice is located now. They've moved out of Sweden. They've moved to fucking Charleston, South Carolina. They're the ones pumping this idea of a white genocide and all these different things. And it's like, as I'm looking at, with this guy, the issue I sort of took with why the fuck did this seemingly trusted thing turn, media organization turn into something else? How is that going to impact people? Again, right. I don't know that. I'm really not trying to link the two.
No. I'm actually curious because I have very limited knowledge of Red Ice. I've seen it, kind of. Is this? I remember seeing something about on one of the websites, one of the Sync websites, yours or Syncbook or something, Sinkhole. I don't remember exactly, but you wrote an open letter to them or something like that, or
that then... is true. Yeah, I did. I mean, they were. It was a podcast. It was a news outlet and a podcast. It was a lot of like. They did do a lot of conspiracy stuff, mm-hmm. but they. Let me put it this way: you and I wouldn't be talking right now if it weren't for them.
Gotcha.
In this sense,
were you affiliated with them at some point?
I mean, not. Particularly,
okay.
I was a guest on the show twice.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But that's not even what I mean. Like,
yeah, I was just curious what the background was.
You know, they were, I don't even know. Like, that's just it. They were a seemingly fairly apolitical podcast.
Gotcha.
That would do, they would do conspiracy stuff. They would do New Age stuff. They would do political stuff. They did like a pretty wide spectrum, alternate sciences and blah, blah, blah. Pretty wide spectrum of stuff. So you didn't really ever feel like there was an agenda there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At least I didn't perceive that.
And when was this when you were talking with them? Or when you were a guest, I guess?
I was a guest in 2011, but they've been around for longer. So I guess I was really trying to give credit for it was the guy who sort of put all right, there's this guy, Jake Kotze, who sort of – he coined the term synchromysticism. He was – when Red Ice first started, they would have Jake on pretty regularly, and they really gave him a platform to share these ideas.
Gotcha.
Which got a lot of people into it.
Totally.
A lot of people ended up making sync blogs. I end up coming along seeing these sync blogs. Again, I'm seeing the product of the product of the product of the product.
Totally, totally. And
as you are now.
As I am.
All I'm trying to say is, that basically they are an essential ingredient, whether for good or for ill.
Sure.
They were an essential ingredient in this whole thing.
Gotcha.
Unfolding. So.
Okay.
And that's the true. I mean, to me, that's ultimately when it comes down to it. We could talk about all the symbols of flags and governments and ideologies. Ultimately, there's a little good and a little bad comes at all of them, I'm sure, you know, in the sense of in what they're responsible for.
Sure. Yeah.
So
to back up, you were, so Red Ice Radio is located in Charleston?
It is now. And it's not, they're not public about that, but it is.
Oh, okay. And they were in Sweden?
The guys from Sweden, I guess we should say, are we doing anything with this audio? Because, whatever, I don't really care. But
we don't have. I mean, if you don't, if you don't want to talk about stuff,
no,
that's
just
fine.
To say
that's fine.
For all the beef I have with them,
yeah,
I'm not trying to be. This is again, it doesn't matter. It probably doesn't matter. But I was asked last time I spoke to them, which was almost exactly a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked not to convey that they were in Charleston because I think he had an ongoing immigration deal and he was kind of still going through a lot of paperwork and
sure.
whatever. Gotcha. So I think it's also good for them as they have a huge European audience.
Yeah, I've heard of it before.
Good, it's probably good for them to still say they're located in Sweden.
Gotcha.
For a number of reasons. Anyway, but the truth is they're in Charleston, South Carolina, and they've spent the last year where I, you know, sort of had my breaking point was they started promoting this idea of a white genocide, which is fucking absurd to me. And I don't know, the whole thing just turned really ugly really fast.
Mm.
To have this kid in Charleston shooting people because he's afraid of a fucking white genocide. The synchronicity there is, it's like too much for me to ignore.
Right. So he's, I haven't looked into any of his manifesto or anything, but is that, he directly said something like that? About a white genocide or?
Correct, yeah.
Wow. I don't think that's necessarily paranoia or anything. I mean, that's, I don't know.
You don't think white genocide? You think white genocide is a potential?
Oh no! I don't think it's paranoid to connect the.
Oh, okay.
The coincidence. Yeah.
Well, I guess all I'm trying to say is I'm trying to say it is. It's definitely a coincidence in that. Excuse me for chewing here.
That's all right.
It's a coincidence in that it's a two things coinciding. It's a coincidence, you know, it's you know, in the most literal sense. I don't know that I don't think they're officially affiliated. I don't think it's like you know, they call up, hey, Storm Roof, go shoot up this church. It's
sure.
Nothing like they, I'm sure they don't know this fucking guy. I don't even know that he's a listener. It's possible.
Right.
It's certainly fucking possible.
It's certainly possible. Yeah.
But it's also possible that it's just a synchronicity that's like in the sense that, hey, they happen to be located in the same place with similar ideologies and I'm taking issue with these guys and meanwhile there's someone who he's not starting a podcast, he's going to go shoot people.
Right.
You know, and so there's, you know, there's the extreme of that ideology.
Right.
Regardless, I mean, you know, an extreme of any ideology, but I don't know. So that was really what I was trying to say, is that, like, this story has got me this, you know, sort of... Oh, so you were saying about the idea of being comfortable and do you, quote-unquote, fight for your freedom, right?
Well, or whatever it is that you believe in, you know, I mean...
Well, precisely,
you know,
precisely.
I mean,
so I guess my... My sort of thing has been like, all right, if you actually believed that there was a white genocide happening, or you believed that the Illuminati was chemtrailing you to, you know, eradicate everyone of all races or whatever, right? Or you thought they're coming to put you in a FEMA camp and you and your family, you know, whatever the fuck. If you really believed any of these, like, more severe conspiracy theories, you would have to at least consider violent action. Out of self, at some point it crosses over to self-defense, if you truly believed it.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, if unless you're, you know, I don't know, a devout Buddhist or something. But yeah, yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even a Jainist would have to at least consider it.
You'd sure.
Have to go, you know, wait a second, am I going to, you know, is this going to... There's something coming to kill me.
Right. Or to take, you know, or to just to, you know, to take you away or to take away your freedom or to take away what you care about. I mean, I think.
If you look at the internet, there are people who are saying, it's not, this is the white genocide is a new spin on it, but I'm saying the idea of a genocide, I've seen, like I said, you know, they are, it's not even a freedom issue, it's a literal life and death. What they're saying is, they want to eradicate, you know, oh, the Georgia Guidestones, they say they want to drop the population down to, you know, 5 million people. You know, so it's like, oh, that means that they're going to eradicate 95% of us. Well, if you believed someone's coming to kill 95% of the country, good chance you're one of them. You know, you'd have to go, what do I do about this?
Right. The thing is I think that...
Is posting on Facebook going to do it? No.
Right. But we've never even come close to... nothing remotely like that has ever... I mean, the closest thing that anyone alive today has experienced probably is to war in this country is 9/11 in terms of actually having something occur on American soil, you know? And I think that... I mean... Just to go off on a small tangent here, I mean, my wife and I, almost exactly a year ago, were in Japan for the first time ever, and we spent 2 weeks just in the city of Tokyo, and just tried to kind of assimilate ourselves into the city, just to really experience it like we lived there. And we were profoundly impressed just by the social culture there in terms of, well, just all of the subtle things about how people just coexist there, we were very receptive to. And, you know, we've even considered trying to move there. We liked it so much, and we're learning Japanese, actually. But, so we were trying to figure out what it was about their culture, other than their history, or their, like, their ancient history or whatever. And I said, you know, they're very unique on this planet in that they're the only country that has ever suffered or been, you know, survived atomic bombs. And I think that I don't want to judge any of that in any way. I just want to say that, you know, just as an observation, I think it's very interesting, the impact of really, really traumatic events occurring to an entire culture. Like, I mean, like in the UK, that's kind of what gave rise to, after World War II, that's what gave rise to their universal healthcare system. And just, we felt that there was just the combination of like the Japanese kind of just, you know, ethos, I guess, and combined with their more recent history. I don't know. It just seemed like, you know, it was such a unique place and such a unique culture, but we were just so taken by the way that people treat each other in a way that it, to them, they do it almost involuntarily. There is just this kind of very, very just collectivist, I guess, attitude, which, you know... I mean, and you know, that's also, I mean, there's all sorts of societies in the past that have really tried to make a go at that and have failed, but I don't know, maybe we were just getting a little burnout on where we live, and so we were kind of just sensitive to that when we got there in the first place, because, you know, I mean, it's just the general sense of disconnectedness and narcissism and that we, you know, is just pervasive, and you just see it everywhere when you go out and on the street, you know. And so we were just, I don't know, we were overwhelmed with that out here.
And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful place. I mean, my wife and I talk regularly about moving there.
Really?
Yeah.
That's all, but, so you've been, have you been more than once?
I've only been once. Mm-hmm. We went, my wife's half Japanese.
Oh, really?
She has family that's there. So they live a little north of Tokyo, so we spent a few days there, and then we went to Tokyo. We also took a train and went out west, and man, I gotta tell you, I mean, I fell in love for sure, but I also, like, I have a friend who moved there, and he's, you know, he's sort of painted for me a sort of reality. Like, so I'll just, I feel like I'm, like, I feel like everything I'm saying is it has the negative spin on it.
No, 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 it's fine. Don't worry about it, man. I'm like a total cynical asshole most of the time.
Well, so here's the, let me just first say, I'm with you. I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it.
No, I'm sure there's a dark side. I'm sure there's a dark side.
I could say a million wonderful things. Like, did you experience, my experience there was produce. The flavor.
Oh yeah!
Of produce. And I was like, I didn't know this is how things are supposed to taste.
I know, dude.
Because everything in America, even you could buy a fucking organic fruit or vegetable here.
Yeah.
But the soil is so fucking depleted, and everything is fucking gassed. And to eat something there was like, oh my god!
I know.
It's
food.
It's simple. It's not like the cuisine. I'm talking about the fucking thing that
anything
was picked off a tree, and it's like we're dug out of the ground. And you're like, this tastes fucking incredible.
Totally.
So to, I can say a million wonderful things, but I guess one thing is, like, I thought was really interesting, just on the, just keep this topic of, like, do you resist something, what do you blah blah blah,
right?
I felt while I was there, there was some sort of debate over what's the big military, American military base, Okinawa. There was some sort of debate about them renewing something or expanding something. So it was a few years ago, and I apologize, I don't remember what the exact thing was. And I remember talking to people there, and they were all kind of like, yeah, it's fucked up. And I'm like, you don't like it? And they're like, well, not really. What are you going to do about it? You know, and I was like, what do you mean? You know, like, this is a foreign country in your country. Isn't there a... And it was just like the idea, there was something almost a defeated something in that, and a colonized air that I know. It's like going into a store and hearing Britney Spears playing on the radio. I was furious. I was like, why the fuck is this happening?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's this very – well, I think that is something – I don't know exactly remember where I read it or heard about it or something, but there is definitely a I think because of World War II, there was a general cultural humbling that occurred. Because, I mean, pride in Japan, in ancient Japanese culture is a real, you know, just the sense of honor, you know, I mean, and their attitude about honor and how seriously they take that stuff. You know, I think in the experience of World War II, culturally kind of caused a nationwide humbling, and that's kind of something that has persisted in just their attitudes. And that's what it makes me think of when you tell that story. You know, is that they almost accept that there is this, they're kind of a, there's a sense of defeatism almost that's ingrained a little bit. You know, in the current, I don't know. I think that's maybe in some of the older generations primarily.
For sure, yeah.
But
and I think the younger generations are sort of enamored with the West, the idea of America, and the older ones are sort of humbled to it.
Exactly.
Again, so it's like, you know, it's like the empire. You know, the they were an empire, so they're used to that idea of, oh, okay, well, now instead of Japan being the head of it. Someone else is the head of it.
Right.
But maybe it actually hasn't changed. It's impossible for me to say. It's not my culture and it's not my time.
Right.
You know, I didn't live through it and I didn't live there.
Right. So. No, I mean, same here. Obviously, right. I'm just trying to, you know, consider it thoughtfully. But I think another thing that's, you know, interesting about Japan in particular is they have their own brand of exceptionalism, and rightly so. I mean, they're very unique geographically and historically. I mean, frankly, the geography of Japan has dictated how unique they are as a culture, you know, just because of they're just far enough to be isolated, but they're just close enough to have some connection with China all throughout their ancient history, and then... you know, there was a whole period, I think, what, the 19th, 17th, 18th, 19th century, I forget exactly, where they were totally isolationist, you know, under the rule of one particular dynasty or something.
Which is fairly easy to do, isn't you're an island nation.
Exactly, right? So I think that has, you know, reinforced their uniqueness. I just got such a sense of how it was such an interesting blend of a very unique culture who is... because, you know, who's very open now to external influence, and you have this unbelievable hybridization, and Tokyo is just this freaking, you know, unbelievable city. Like, it's just super organism, like mega anthill, like, you know, from the future. I mean,
yeah, I'm a native New Yorker, and I go to any. And I go to any city, and I feel like, what is this shit?
New York City?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's like, you call this a fucking city. I went to Tokyo, and I was like, all right, now it's my turn to be humble.
Yeah, dude, it was, oh. I love how each subway station is a fucking city in itself. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I want to go back so bad. We were so miserable when we got back.
I went through like a period of like postpartum.
Dude, that's like what we called it. We had Japan postpartum.
Yeah.
And we,
you know, making it worse, we flew, the cheapest flight was into Newark, New Jersey, which is like the shittiest airport in America, assume. I don't know if it gets worse than that.
We entered, but it's funny, you know, because we entered back through LAX, which was pretty dismal. I mean, it's a nice airport, but just like the vibe when we, because we had to, you know, we had to still fly back to SFO, and we were just like, oh my God, we're so depressed. Why are we here? Well, that's cool, man. Yeah. Japan. Oh, loved it.
Gotta make a, you know, we'll make a, I was telling somebody else, like, that's the next Sync Summit is in Japan.
Dude! let me know if you need any help coordinating that.
It's basically just an excuse. Basically means I'm going to go, whoever wants to meet me there.
I'll be there. For sure. That's awesome.
So speaking of which, what was on your mind? Was there anything in particular?
Yeah, actually there was. I just wanted to like ask, because I don't know that it ever really or we ever really finished talking about it, but about doing a podcast.
I'm so down.
Okay, good.
As I recalled, what we sort of left it was you were gonna. You know, you're like, all right, well, I'm just kind of stewing in my mind's, you know, you had ideas all over and you're kind of thinking about it.
Yeah, and that's what I've been up to. I mean, like, that's what I've been doing, just churning away for a while, just kind of figuring all of that out.
So have you come to any sort of answers in that respect?
Yeah, I have.
Please. Oh, I would love to hear it.
All right. Well, as far as something that I would do for my own show type of thing, I came up with a name for it, which is Fine Just Fine, which is what it's called. And the basic theme or tone.
While you talk, so if you don't hear me responding, it's just my mic is muted.
Oh, no worries, no worries. So, and the basic theme would be form and noise in communication, basically, which is a very broad topic. But and some of the things that we talked about before, where I was explaining about, you know, every episode would essentially explain itself about how it was made, and that's definitely still something I'm interested in. I feel like making that the central theme was kind of turning it into something that I started working with that kind of framework and wasn't really liking what I was putting together. So I wanted it to be a little bit more loose. So I've been having some conversations with a few people that I've collaborated with over the years and made some recordings, and also I'm interested in speaking with yourself and various members of the whole SyncBook community. I'm just interested in kind of, you know, officiating the whole thing in some way. It's just so that I can just kind of get the ball rolling on cranking out some episodes, and just wanted to know what the policy was, or how you like to do things, or whatever you want to incorporate it or whatever.
I mean, there is no policy except for whatever we make, you know. So the thing that would be a most ideal situation for me, especially over the next few months, what I'm doing is, working as a waiter, particularly in shitty-ass Virginia where I am right now, I have to make the most of summertime money.
Gotcha.
This is when I will make my money for the year. So basically I'm working every opportunity I get. I'm not able to produce much or be online much.
Gotcha.
I probably won't be till the summer season is over. So the most ideal thing in a lot of ways would be that you're essentially as self-sufficient as possible.
That's totally fine.
But that also means, you know, full creative license. You know, I don't want to tell you what to do. I want to listen to it and enjoy it. And,
right on.
You know, and assist. Basically, what the way I look at it is, what I would be doing, or I guess I'll say this. So there's a few. The only real specific things we would sort of need would be things like, when you're going to create an MP3, I'm going to need you to put your metadata in. I'm going to tell you just a certain like fields that have to be filled out.
Got it. No problem.
And we have a guy from France who does all our webmastering.
Right.
And he built a sort of like a website, like a podcast publishing code for us. So.
Oh, cool.
So that basically, like, we fill out certain fields, and we can say, we want this to go out on the RSS feed, you know.
Right.
We want this to be published as, you know, with this information or whatever.
Sure, sure.
So.
So when I deliver, so basically, it's just a specific format or way I add all the relevant metadata to whatever I deliver to you. It has to adhere to some publishing format or whatever.
Right, which is, it's nowhere near what you went through with the film stuff. It's nothing like that.
No, I understand, but I get it.
It'll basically be, like, we have all our stuff, since it's all going out as MP3s, we had to go back and change a lot of old stuff, just to standardize stuff, because people were saying, hey, when I download this on my iPod, or whatever, I don't even know if people have iPod. I still have an iPod. I don't know, but people probably have iPhones probably work the same way, right?
Yeah.
You can sort by artist or album or sure. whatever, right?
Sure.
So we standardize that our...
All the metadata, yeah.
Yeah, so the artist for everything is SyncBook Radio, but then the album is like always record. The album is 42 minutes.
Got
the
it.
Album would be fine, just fine. Cool. And then, you know, things like that.
Okay.
So this way, it's just so that it's everyone's able to sort it the same way. And like I said, just a few things like that for publishing.
So like when, for example, when you get a new episode of Pentimental or something like that from those guys, what do they send you? Not only the MP3 that's properly has all the right standard metadata, but they send you the album artwork and then like a synopsis. Do they do that too?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So, the album artwork, like, I do all the ones for Always Record.
Okay.
Usually, there's a David's done some, but most of those are me. I was doing 42 minutes for a while, and now Doug's doing it.
Okay.
And Pentimental, there's Thomas, who I've never met, but he's the Sometimes co-host. Is a brilliant fucking designer.
Yeah, dude, those are impressive.
Those are really amazing.
Yeah.
So those are him.
Awesome.
Just trying to think out loud. So okay. So right, synchronize. What do we got here? So Marty's providing his own. So he made a template. And if you've ever looked at Marty's show.
Yeah, sure.
He made a template for himself so he could drop in the picture of the guest and some whatever.
Gotcha.
Which, you know, I think is like, it's great at a small size. Like I love that he's branded it, that everything's got like the sync book and the logo on it. But I also think that if he keeps producing those shows regularly, a whole wall with all of that could end up.
It gets a little
redundant.
Yeah. And saturated, I guess, but okay, so yeah, and I'm happy to provide that stuff. So
do you have interest and/or capability of providing images as well?
Yes.